Welcome to the Near Joshua Podcast. My name is Isaac Kamens. This is a bi-weekly podcast where my friend Jess O'Brien and I discuss internal martial arts, Qigong, and meditation. This week we begin a series of episodes on the teacher T.T. Liang. First we look at Bruce Francis's account of training with T.T. Liang. Then we turn to T.T. Liang's student Stuart Olson's book, Steal My Art, where we look at Stuart's first few encounters with T.T. Liang. Then we turn back to the Tai Chi classics and we begin discussing the Song of Pushing Hands. This one is not in Baihua's book, so we look at Barbara Davis's and T.T. Liang's versions of that. And in our Patreon extended episode, I tell the one and only story I have about somebody coming and challenging Bruce. So you can check out the Patreon for that. There's also a full bonus episode to go along with each regular episode. So go to the head over to the Patreon, check that out. All right, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy the episode. Take care of yourselves and be well.
In today's episode, we're going to continue our look at the Yang style of Tai Chi and some of the colorful characters involved. One of America's favorite Tai Chi teachers was T.T. Liang from Taiwan, who was one of the early teachers on the East Coast, Boston and New York area. And a lot of folks came through his class over the years. He was a prolific teacher, a very amiable guy who welcomed a lot of people into his classes. And so he was one of the early teachers, and he taught for decades and actually lived to be, I believe, over 100 years old. So we wanted to dig into his life story a little bit and some of the wild and crazy adventures he went on as a Tai Chi master. So let's start with a piece of his biography from Power of Internal Martial Arts by B.K. Francis, where he gives a pretty good description of T.T. Liang and his life and his experience with T.T. Liang. So here's how he starts off. He says, "An example of a wonderful Tai Chi teacher who was a true pleasure to be around was Liang Tung Tsai, T.T. Liang. Liang was a charming older man, balding, with a twinkle in his eye and a devilish who-me smile. He had what the French call joie de vivre, or joy of life. He was one of Cheng Man Jing's senior students in Taiwan. He came to America, taught Tai Chi in New York City at the United Nations, handed over the class back to Master Cheng, and moved to Boston, where he taught for many years. Liang taught a version of the Yang Tai Chi system. No matter how cold the weather got, in Boston, it was said, Liang always made your heart feel warm. He was an insightful teacher and excellent communicator. Students found that studying with him, hanging out in his apartment, or taking walks with him was always a genuine pleasure." So he notes here that Liang taught the Cheng Man Ching long form that Zheng first taught in Taiwan before he changed to teaching his 37-movement short form. Over 8 or 9 months in 1972, Liang taught B.K. Francis solo forms for sword, broadsword, double broadsword, two-person Tai Chi fencing set, push hands, and his version of the two-person set he called the two-person dance. So that's kind of the whole Yang-style curriculum right there, if not more.
Yeah,
that's and he had the whole deal. It's interesting, though, that he taught the long form of Cheng Man Ching rather than the more popular 37-move form that most people are more familiar with. So yeah, just on that topic of the curriculum of the Yang style, I've been able to visit some teachers over the years. And my first teacher actually had his own version of the 88-move two-person Tai Chi set, which is called Sancho, Tai Chi Sancho. And that's where you get to do the applications on each other, which is kind of the weak point of Tai Chi in this modern era, right, to say the least. But it gives you a nice, easy intro that allows you to do it without feeling stressed out. And like people who've never done an application in their life get to elbow somebody or kick somebody in the knee or, you know, so that's super a good way to get your feet into the water. And some of them are kind of corny and weird that don't make a lot of sense, which is true of even Xing Yi and Bagua two-person forms. Sometimes you end up doing some very odd looking stuff in Chinese martial arts that you wouldn't think of as a high percentage fighting move or whatever. But also sometimes they have little hidden lessons in them that make sense over time, or later you realize there's something to it. That's my feeling. Some people just cut them out and say, you know, teacher Luo Deshu, he's just like, there's no sense in any of these two-person forms. He's like, let's just do the fighting applications and strategies and tactics. Like, don't waste your time on extended, long, involved two-person forms. I think Kumar is the same way.
Yeah, I was just gonna say. I mean, I've never done any, except when you made me do them. I never did any two-person forms.
Right. I think they're sick though. There's something classical and old-fashioned about them. I kind of like how odd they are and sort of you can tell they're from an earlier time before the current world of martial arts. They
I think they're demonstration forms, but
yeah.
that's my
But like
opinion.
they could look a lot. I mean, the two-person Tai Chi form, it's got a lot of the moves are kind of passive and sort of receptive. Retaliatory type of moves that are kind of you're allowing them to come into your space and then you go back. So it does capture the Tai Chi approach, that sort of soft approach. And some of them are some tricky applications. Like I remember one is they do a roundhouse to your head. So you go up with the elbow inside their elbow, catch their elbow with yours, and then boom, you oh back fist right to their face, which is kind of sweet. Kind of risky. Like if someone throws a haymaker and you try to like catch their arm with your arm, like on the right perfect point. If you can envision that. But you know, there's some basic ones where you kick them in the nuts or whatever, and you grab both their hands and kick them in the nuts with
Right. I
the
mean, well,
lotus kick kind of like that's kind of
I
dope.
mean, like you said, I think it's just a way of doing application or learning the applications without doing the applications, right? Like
Right.
you don't actually, no one actually gets, hurt or hit hard.
Right.
It's more controlled because
Yeah.
it's a, but that's always been the purpose of those, two
You
person sets is
got to
to give
start with light.
part of the bridge between your solo form and your, free fighting is you have to learn what counters what when, and
Right.
the sort of spy versus spy kind of thing.
Yeah. And that inspires you to then, you don't have to do that exact one. You do something, just take that idea and apply it in a bunch of different ways,
Right. I
basically.
mean, and one of the, well, I mean, one of the considerations is, aside from the fact that if somebody commits to it, you got them for a couple more years, is that, as a teacher, it's safer, It's like, it's not as safe as push hands, maybe. It's like, a little bit more
Right, it's the
engaged
next
than
step,
push
yeah.
hands, but it's still not, the likelihood that two people are going to get fired up and just start throwing haymakers at each other is pretty low.
Right.
Where, if you when you start getting into the some more like fighting application aspects of it, people can get kind of heated. So it can
Right.
end up, people throwing pretty hard punches and stuff and kicks and.
And another aspect was that I was coming into this at a young age, like 16 or 17 years old. So I was like allergic to doing the long form. Like my brain was not prepared to do a long form. But by doing the two person, we started with the two person form. Me and my buddy started the class, and the teacher was like, you know what? Why don't we just do the two person form? You guys seem to like that. So we actually learned the Sancho before we even learned the long form itself. And it gave me something to put my mind into that I could get, that made sense to me, that was, at
Yeah,
least had
well,
a
I mean,
slight bit of realism to it compared to some slow ass form.
I think that's one of his characteristics is he was an inspiring teacher, and part of inspiring people is to get them to get over the fear of doing it, and then that kind of leads to,
Right. In my case, the boredom of doing it, because I was too young to
yeah,
do Tai
or
Chi.
whatever. But
You
yeah,
shouldn't put
it's
a
a,
teenager in a Tai Chi class. Like, that's the worst place to
well, I
be.
mean, like, I mean, I was, what was I, so I was 19 when I started doing
So we're about the same.
Tai Chi, and it was the I say again, I mean, when I learned Tai Chi, it was all applications, so I
Yeah.
wasn't
See, you
learning.
were kind of
I was
lucky there.
really,
Yeah.
I mean,
There wasn't a lack of fighting in that class.
yeah, I mean,
Whereas most people got
it
to a Tai
wasn't.
Chi class is just following teacher through a whole bunch of moves.
I mean, I can only in those early years remember one time where we, like free sparred in class. But every single class was, here's the movement, here's the principle behind the movement. And now spend the rest of the class doing applications with the movement. Like that was how you practiced the other stuff was through application. I mean, at the beginning of class and at the end of class, you do the form, but the majority of the time between the beginning of the class and the end of the class was done with some kind of two-person
Right.
exercise,
Pick one
whether.
move from the form or two and use
Yeah, I mean, in the
those
early days it was
applications.
more fighting, and later it was more push hands, and later it was just these sort of two-person kind of awareness exercises.
Yeah.
It depends on the crowd, but
Right. Those are the ways you can apply it.
yeah,
And of course, that helps you
some of these.
remember the moves and helps you give context to why you're punching in one direction instead of the other or moving your leg a certain way. Like it helps you remember the logic behind some of the motions in the form, which it's a workout to remember a Tai Chi form. Definitely helped me ever since I learned that long form when I was a kid, I could do any kung fu class I went to. I could remember the forms they were teaching pretty well because nothing's as hard as a 108 Tai Chi form. So here's the next piece from TT. So he says, Liang was not the least bit sanctimonious about Tai Chi, as is the case with some elderly Chinese teachers. He was educated in both Chinese and English and had learned and loved many martial arts in his youth. In the 1930s and 40s, Liang was a customs official in Shanghai. At that time, the Chinese underworld controlled the docks. Shanghai was then one of the most raucous cities in existence, with perhaps the world's largest active red light district. Liang always liked regaling students with risque stories of those days in the wild, wild east. Just to take a side note, we've mentioned a few times in these older teachers that we've talked about is how the 1930s and 40s, 20s, 30s, and 40s in, on coastal China was an absolute like free for all, basically, with all the countries in the world trading over there and like money is just flying around and the corruption among the officials. So like the gangster to official pipeline was in full swing of sort of like in America, the corporate to Congress, like you become a high level official, then you join the industry and then you have all the connections. And so all kinds of illicit goods and activities were just at a fever pitch in Shanghai in that era.
Yeah, and this is that same period of time that we were talking about with like Lin Yuying and
Tian Zhaoling.
Chen Zhaolin being connected with certain elements, so
But certain elements, I like
yeah.
that. So yeah, this is that same zone. Let's see here. So Liang would tell his students that he took up Tai Chi because he had ruined his liver by excessively partaking in the good life. So there you have it. He learned Tai Chi to recover his lost health, and although he had studied with 20 Tai Chi teachers, he considered Cheng Manqing to be the best, even though he and Cheng disagreed on some issues. So it sounds like they may have even been kind of the same generation a little bit. Liang and Cheng, like in terms of age. I don't think Liang was much younger than Cheng
No.
Manqing. And Cheng Manqing died quite young in the, I believe, in the 1970s, right?
74, I
And
think.
TT outlasted him by 25 more years, basically. So that's two different stories of Tai Chi. Like they both practiced Tai Chi, but one died pretty young, and then the other guy lived to be 100. Like, was Tai Chi a factor there, or was it just genetics,
I have always heard that Chen Minjing died from bad booze, but who
Right. But nobody, do you think he outdrank T.T. Liang?
No, but there's a
I think
difference.
T.T. Liang quit. It's sort of like the
I was
smoker who
going to say
quit versus the guy who keeps smoking.
there's a difference between drinking in your 40s and drinking in your 70s.
Right.
Like when you get to a certain age, it starts to take its toll, I think, a
Right.
bit more.
Yeah, you got to quit partying before it's too late, basically. So he says, Liang was always open-minded and willing to grow and learn. He was inspired by his students. On the other side of 70 in Taiwan, he started learning half-step praying mantis from an 80-year-old master from Shandong, Wei Xiaotong, who was as strong as a bull and who did Tai Chi to keep his gung fu from deteriorating in old age. Not many men of Liang's age would have been open enough to start anything from scratch. Liang always said that if you truly loved martial arts or had genuine passion for any of the other wonderful things life had to offer, you would never let your past achievements stop you from learning something valuable and new. With this attitude, Liang had in effect found one of the streams of the Fountain of Youth. So yeah. In his late 70s, he started praying mantis. That's pretty cool. All right, well, that's a little bit about the history of T.T. Leon. We're going to look at Steal My Art, The Life and Times of Tai Chi Master T.T. Leon by Stuart Olson, published by North Atlantic Books in 2002. And Stuart's a longtime student of T.T. Leon's and has had some great stories of their adventures together. So he's like this young wandering martial arts bro who ends up showing up at T.T. Leon's, who's already got to be in his 70s. Early one morning, a few months after I had moved into the basement apartment of T.T. Leong's home in Minnesota, he shouted down to me in a very disgruntled tone, "Bloody, get the car ready. We must leave immediately. Hurry up." Just immediately just shouting at him, "Hurry up." I had been sitting in meditation, and his shouting, slamming of the upstairs door and loud stomping of feet back to his bedroom jolted me from my samadhi. I had no idea what was wrong or where we were going, but I knew that his tone was serious and I should get ready quickly. Within minutes, I was sitting in the car in the driveway, waiting for him to come out the back door of the house, feeling anxious and concerned about what problem caused him to be so upset. Moments later, he appeared, dressed as he always was when going out in public, wearing his black canvas shoes and black dress slacks, pulled over his obviously protruding chi belly, held in place by his worn-out, tightly buckled brown belt. And of course, he had on his tan cloth wind jacket, which he wore no matter the temperature over his white dress shirt, and more often than not, blue Mickey Mouse sweatshirt with the image of Mickey clearly showing through the white t-shirt. Placed tightly on his head was his constant companion, an off-white cap that allowed his silvery white hair to hang loosely out of the elastic binding. The final and most important article was his large, tattered, and faded yellow shoulder bag, in which he carried all of his important items. His checkbook, ID card, cough drops, butterscotch candies, an old crumpled handkerchief, and loose change. Right, so Stuart's waiting in the car, sort of anxious about what's going on. Making sure the door was locked, Master Lang stood at the edge of the uppermost step, leaning over while pressing on one side of his nose and blew phlegm onto the ground. He did the same with his other nostril and then pulled out a spare handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his nose clean. When he was finished, he descended the steps and headed to the car.
Jesus.
He presented the same posturing and image every time we left the house. Although it irritated me, I strangely looked forward to seeing it every time, as it just wouldn't have been him if he didn't perform this ritual.
Funny.
After helping him into the car, I asked where we were going. "Take me to the bank," he ordered. "Don't talk, just drive." And so I did. Throughout the 2 mile drive, all he did was grumble and cuss, revealing nothing coherent about what was wrong, although obviously showing that he was upset. At one point, I politely asked him what this was all about. As I heard back, all I heard back was a lecture about how I was just a small baby, wet behind the ears, and knew nothing about the ills and troubles of this red dust world. I then decided it was best to just be quiet and drive. When we reached the bank, I was relieved, knowing he would go inside and I would get a reprieve from his obvious bad mood and irritating temper. But no such luck, as he turned to me and ordered me to go in the bank with him. "I must withdraw a large sum of cash," he said, "and you must be sure no one tries to rob me." So this is like back in the Shanghai days. He wants to get a big bundle full of cash and
Right.
hit the streets. Once inside, he made me stand right beside him at the counter while he wrote out his check and withdrew his money. After the bank clerk counted out his cash, $1,000 exactly, he picked it up and turned, holding the money out to me. "Take the money," he whispered. "Hold it for safety." The instant the money was in my hand, he stepped back, pointed accusingly at me, and loudly began shouting, "This young man robbed me. He forced me to write a check. Arrest this man. This is a bank heist." My face immediately flushed from confusion and fear. I began stuttering out denials. The bank guard, who was about 40 feet away, quickly began rocking towards me, and I saw his hand fumbling to release the holster strap over his gun. The bank was dead silent. Everyone turned to look at me. But then Pam, the vice president, who knew me and Mr. Leong well because she had taken several Tai Chi lessons from us, started laughing uproariously and waved off the security guard. Thank God, this lady just happens to know him.
That's great.
Damn. Then, almost uncontrollably, Liang followed with his trademark giggling, and a sigh of relief fell over the entire bank. As my blood and breathing returned to somewhat normal levels and my brain started to function, I shouted him, "What are you doing, sir? I could have been killed." To which he just kept chuckling. Pam strolled over and attempted to reprimand him, although she could not subdue her own laughter while doing so. He then informed us that he needed to place something valuable in his safe deposit box and asked me to wait on the couch in the lobby while he did so. So I grabbed a newspaper and decided it was best to sit and hide behind it. As I sat there, I overheard a young couple talking. The woman said, "Isn't that old Chinese man cute? He looks so lovable." "Yeah, right," I grumbled to myself. "Real lovable." Time passed and no Master Liang. I looked around. I couldn't see him, so I assumed he was still in the safe deposit box area and went back to reading my paper. Moments later, however, Pam came over. Stuart, are you going to drive your teacher home today?" "Yes," I answered, lowering the paper. "Well, you better hurry." She pointed out the window. Liang was walking about a block away. I hurriedly gathered myself and dashed to the car. When I pulled up to him, I peered out the window and asked if he needed a ride. He stood there fully upright, looking up and away from me, which I later came to call his emperor stance, and responded in an aloof manner. "You have no eyes. You have eyes, but no pupils and no human feelings. A young man must be more compassionate to an old man. But I guess I'll accept your offer for a ride because my situation is so desperate and hopeless." On the way back, he confessed to me that he had spent the night figuring out a way in which he could try to upset me, to raise my chi, and so came up with the bank heist plot to test my temperament. "Nice. You have failed and you have passed," he said. "On the one hand, you were really fooled and your face showed fear. But on the other hand, you didn't attempt to kill me. So I think you did quite well, young man." Hearing this, I was half amused and half not.
Wow.
Dude, just putting him through hell.
Well, that reminds me. Remember when Jamie told this story about David Barbaro? TT.
David Barbaro is when your classmate who learned from TT.
Yeah, and he look at the Patreon episode if you want the full story, but essentially did the same kind of thing. And I ended with
this wasn't the only time he pulled this trick.
Yeah.
Lucky Pam was there in Stewart's case to interrupt.
But I think
I can just see the security guard just going for his gun like this.
Oh, I think that was the thing he liked to do with people, the sort of, you know, see if he eyes out of them.
So far, we've been looking at the Taiji classics as presented in Bai Hua's book. But there's one piece of the Taiji classics, well, probably a lot more than one, but there's one common Taiji classic that's included in most of the Yang style schools that he doesn't include in his book, called the Pushing Hands Song or the Playing Hands Song. So I wanted to pull from the Taiji Chung classics as translated by Barbara Davis. That's North Atlantic Books 2004. And so she gives an introduction to it that's pretty cool. It says, "The Playing Hands Song is an easy to memorize ditty about Taiji Chung's two person form. The four main push hands moves are mentioned in the first line, ward off, roll back, press, and push. And the balance of the poem consists of brief reminders of the principles and applications of the push hands techniques. The Playing Hands Song is of unknown origin. It has a 7-character per line rhythm and a simple, although occasionally irregular, rhyme scheme. It is the only piece found in early written materials of both Yang and Chen Tai Chi schools. This kind of training chant is commonly used in China in many avenues to help students memorize ideas, tasks, and methods." So I thought that was very interesting. This is the only one that Yang and Chen schools both have, which makes the Yang-Chen connection seem... I mean, people always wonder, was the legend of Yang Luchan true? Did he go to Chen Village or did he just make it up himself? If they both share classics, that would point to a proof of a connection.
It sure would. I mean, at least on push hands level.
So it says, "In some editions of the classics, including Chen Wei Ming's, a prose paragraph is often included with the Playing Hands Song that in other editions is placed in the exposition."
That's what Bai Hua does. So at the end of the Tai Chi Chuan Qing, he sticks in a real short, it's not the classic, but it's where he puts in a little bit about push hands.
The way these books are constructed, going through Bai Hua's has been really interesting to see how it's constructed. And then compared to these other books, you can see those similarities of the repetitions and the way that you start off by laying it out, all out the key points.
Yeah,
and then you do this whole historical breakdown. Yeah.
He just has the illustration of it.
Mm-hmm. He's got that push hands diagram.
Counters what kind of thing?
Barbara Davis says, "As for the title, Da Sho literally means to hit or to play hands, i.e. push hands. Ge means ditty, chant, song, or poem. Chen Weiming appends to the title a note that says, "Playing hands, Dasho refers namely to Tui Sho." So let's start with the first sentence. Ward off, roll back, press, and push must be done conscientiously. Those are the first four moves. Those are the Tai Chi's most famous moves and most effective moves and most practiced moves. So there you go.
We were talking about two-person exercises, right? Well, the first basic pattern of Tui Sho is you're learning how to do the grasping the sparrow's tail as a, you know, both offensive slash defensive thing, right? You know, so you're getting those four techniques in a two-person activity, right? I'm not going to say it's combative yet, but it's
not quite yet, but getting there.
it's semi-cooperative, let's put it that way.
You get to feel force put on you, and you get to put force on someone else. That's something you got to start somewhere. Most people don't know that.
The techniques of Tai Chi. I mean, I think one of the things that's often lost and when people start doing push-ins is when they get excited that they lose the fact that you're supposed to be doing it using the Tai Chi techniques, not just winning.
Right, just hunkering down and pushing as hard as you can.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't the right way to start necessarily. Yeah,
well, you can win doing push-ins without doing push-ins, right? Without doing Tai Chi,
right?
But if you want to,
push-ins has a rule set that you can do stuff in,
and that's where I think that distinction of hitting versus put right, maybe we don't hit each other and we just kind of push each other around. And
so the next line is, my upper and lower follow each other, and so the opponent finds it difficult to get into me. So she breaks that down and says, this idea is elaborated by Yang Cheng Fu in his 10 important points, in which he says, you must have the whole body in one chi. If even one part does not move, disorder will result. So it sounds like she's trying to say this upper and lower follow each other. Basically, you're becoming one would be one of the ways to put it.
Keep your shoulders over your hips.
So she further says that when your body is truly united with one chi, you can create an impervious presence. So there you go. All right. Well, let's continue the conversation next time.
All right, brother. Sounds good.
Thanks, bro.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Hey folks, hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks for listening. Just another reminder, go over to the Patreon and check out the extended episode and the bonus episode, as well as all the other stuff we have up there, interviews. And we also have Instagram where I post images to go along with the episodes. All right, take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening and be well.